The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, Natalie Villacorta, writer for Science, is here with some of the latest stories from our daily news site. First up, we've got some illuminating research about calculating risk in basketball.
Right. So the first story we have here is on the mathematics of basketball. Basically, a new paper came out the other day that's looking at when the best time to take aim is.
So where did the idea for this paper come from?
Well, Brian Skinner, the author of this paper, he's actually a grad student at the University of Minnesota in theoretical physics. In 2007, he went to a talk at the American Physical Society meeting, and he heard a talk about the flow of traffic. The ideas he heard about this traffic inspired him and kind of reminded him of a theory that he'd heard about basketball.
So he actually created an analogy between traffic and basketball.
That's right, yeah. So at the meeting, they were talking about how the average driver, when they're driving, they're really trying to reduce their own personal time, not the average time of every driver out on the road. And this reminded him of a theory in basketball named after Patrick Ewing, who was a high-scoring player for the New York Knicks. Analysts had noticed that when Ewing or other big scorers sat out on the bench, the team actually was more likely to win.
And so he wanted to investigate why this actually is.
That's right. So last year, he published a paper showing that virtually every equation from traffic theory could be applied to basketball, which is pretty cool. So what he's doing in this new paper is trying to predict when the best time to take a shot is. And his findings are pretty surprising.
Can you name a few of those findings?
Sure. One of the more obvious findings is that the more seconds that are left on the clock, for example, NBA teams have 24 seconds to possess the ball before they need to shoot. And in men's college basketball, you have 35 seconds. So the more seconds that are left on the clock, the choosier a player should be, and they should pass up all the shots except for the highest quality ones.
Okay, so that one's relatively intuitive. Were there others that were a little bit more surprising?
Right. So if you think about two teams, A and B, both of which have the same chance of scoring, the same ball turnover rate, and the same number of seconds left on the clock to shoot, but Team A is twice as fast as passing as Team B, you'd probably think that Team A should shoot twice as fast as Team B. Say, Team A would shoot every 10 seconds if Team B is shooting every 20 seconds. But what Skinner actually found out is that Team A should shoot every 13 seconds, 3 seconds longer than what you might actually think, giving them a few more seconds to be selective about what shots to make.
So, in essence, he's saying that taking a little bit more time is actually really beneficial to you in the long term.
That's right.
Now, on paper, these results are great. How easy do you think they're actually going to be to implement in the game?
Well, apparently, basketball coaches and managers are more receptive than they've ever been before to putting these models into practice. The problem is that Skinner actually hasn't been able to get his hands on any data from professional teams yet.
All right, well, I'll look forward to seeing how this works out.
Yeah, the next time you're on the court, think about whether you're shooting too often or not often enough, and what the other players, whether they're good or bad, should be doing.
Next up, we've got a story about how vampire bats have evolved to detect warm-blooded meals.
Right, so vampire bats are pretty nasty creatures. Not only do they suck the blood of cows, but also suck human blood. So watch out the next time your toe's poking out from underneath your covers.
Now, vampire bats have to feed on what sounds like an enormous amount of blood to survive.
Yeah, they actually consume 70 to 80% of their body weight in blood almost every night.
Now, how exactly do they locate the meals to get this much blood?
Researchers located this ion channel called the TRPV1. Normally, this channel stimulates sensory neurons that are activated in response to painful heat.
And so this gene is what's responsible for that tingly feeling when you've eaten something really spicy.
This is correct. But in vampire bats, the version of this ion channel has actually been truncated through an alternative splicing of the TRPV1 gene. So what's interesting is that in other animals, 40 degrees Celsius threshold is required to activate these channels. But researchers found after they inserted the genetic instructions for this shortened TRPV1 channel into frog egg cells, that the threshold for this shortened version of the channel is 31 degrees Celsius, which is 9 degrees lower than the threshold required to activate the longer version found in other animals.
So bats can, in essence, detect bodies that are slightly cooler than what they otherwise would have been able to detect.
That's right. Vampire bats have adapted this channel to be activated at the temperature of warm-blooded animals and human blood.
So does this mean that when a bat lands on warm prey, its nose actually tingles?
I'm not quite sure about that, but the researchers did find that these shortened channels are only in the bats' faces, not found in nerves located in other parts of their body.
All right, well, no pain, no gain, I guess.
Right. The researchers should bring in Dracula and see whether he's got these sensors in his chin.
Okay, and lastly today, scientists have been chiseling away at an explanation for why the moon has such a dramatic geography.
So the biggest question in lunar science was, what's the origin of Earth's moon? But now that we know that the Earth was formed from debris that splashed off the Earth from an enormous impact, the biggest question is, why does the moon have its two-sided geology?
So by two-sided geology, you're referring to the fact that one half of the moon is pretty flat, pretty low-lying, but the other one is more mountainous?
That's right. The side that profiles the man or the woman on the moon is relatively flat, whereas on the other side, the terrain is very mountainous. This has puzzled scientists for a while.
And so what do they think happened?
Impact modelers from the University of California, Santa Cruz proposed that perhaps this dichotomous terrain was created by an impact.
An impact on the low-lying side or the mountainous side?
Well, the scientists think that the impact actually occurred on the mountainous side of the moon.
So that's unusual. We usually think of impacts resulting in craters. How could one actually result in creating mountains?
Well, that's a question that the researchers were faced with when they were creating this model. The scientists realized that if the cause was an impact, it was going to have to be a very slow-moving impactor. Because as you mentioned, otherwise a crater would have formed, not a mountainous terrain.
Oh, very interesting. And so how could they explain that?
What they're proposing is that the debris that created our moon also created a smaller sister moon, a third of the size of our moon. What they think happened is that the sister moon, moving at a little more than a tenth of the speed of usual impactors, splattered onto the mountainous side. The reason why mountainous terrain was created instead of a crater is because of this extremely slow-moving sister moon. So you can kind of think of it like throwing mud against a wall.
So step by step, what would have happened when these two bodies collided?
So what happened in the collision is that magma that was in the magma ocean, still lingering beneath the lunar crust, was squished over to the near side, the flat side that has the profile of the man or the woman in the moon. So it's thought that the heat generated from this magma could have created the dark lavas on the lunar maria.
And what kind of feedback have these scientists gotten so far?
Scientists don't think that this is a crazy idea, but it's important to keep in mind that these are just models. There's no hard evidence. And it'll actually have an opportunity to be tested when NASA's Gravity Recovery and Interior Laboratory mission, which is scheduled to be launched in September, probes the lunar interior, and it should return some of the most sensitive measurements of lunar gravity that has ever been made.
All right, so what other exciting science news do we have this week?
So we've got a shot on an extremely rare disease in which people do not actually have fingerprints. This disease is called achromatoglyphia, and it's also referred to as immigration delay disease because individuals with the disease, there's actually only been 4 known families ever documented with this disease. Individuals who are affected with this disease report having difficulty crossing borders.
Oh, wow. So what were scientists researching in this case?
They were trying to figure out what the mutation is that causes this rare disorder, and they pinpointed one mutation that they think is the cause of this unusual disease. Another exciting story we have going on for Science Now this week is a very exciting discovery. Researchers from Kyoto University have found a way to turn mouse embryonic stem cells into sperm. So when these cells were transplanted into mice that were unable to produce sperm normally, the stem cell-derived primordial germ cells produced normal-looking sperm, which were then used to successfully fertilize eggs.
Does this process have the potential for being used in humans later on?
I think it's too early to tell, but they did show that the fertilized eggs, when transplanted into a recipient mother, produced healthy offspring that grew into fertile male and female adult mice. In the future, this could really help out couples who are unable to have children right now.
Absolutely.
Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat about the hottest topics in science, we'll be talking about the future of stem cell research. This topic has come up after last week's ruling in Shirley versus Sibelius that federally funded research on human embryonic stem cells is legal. The ruling ends 11 months of uncertainty about whether human stem cell research supported by the National Institutes of Health would suddenly be shut down. Please join us at 3 p.m. on Thursday for a live chat to discuss what's next with Shirley versus Sibelius and what it's like to work in a research field where the rules are always changing.
Natalie Villacorta is a writer for Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.